With our two special guests, Chris Stiles and Graham Sims, their book is called Impact to Contact. We're talking about the Shag Harbor incident. Incredible story. We'll be back with more, and we'll take your calls, too, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Chris Stiles and Graham Sims with us here. Graham, let's say hi to you before something happens again. They take you away.
I'm back.
Good. Perfect. Chris, we're talking about this Pan Am Flight 160. Let's review about that again. It was a near collision case back in October 5th, 1967, a day after the major Shag Harbor incident. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right, George. What it was is that Pan Am Flight 160 was a regular flight that did a route. It was a cargo plane on Boeing, I believe it was a 707, and used to fly weekly. It would take off from JFK, and it would go across the Atlantic to Heathrow, and on the next leg, the next day, it would continue on to Tokyo and then reverse. It was a regular route anyway for a cargo flight. And what happened was the next night there, the Thursday on the 5th, they had taken off a little later than usual from JFK, and as the way they were still, a heavy aircraft filled with cargo, slowly still ascending, building attitude even out over the Gulf of Maine. And as at some point when they were midpoint, say, coming across the water there, a set of four lights had dropped down in front of them, and it looked kind of like landing lights staring at them. And, the pilot, Kurt Olson, was radio, and he was in contact with, it would have been Boston, Logan Airport. And he was asking them if they were painting anything, because he thought it was curious. It was very definitely there, again, perfect conditions in the sky. And yet, he was painting nothing on the radar, and neither were they. The only thing they had in terms of traffic at all near them was behind them, and that was a refueling SAC mission about 20,000 feet below. So anyway, he kept asking. He was in radio contact the whole time, and slowly they began gaining on these things, and they were right in front of their nose. And the crew was getting more and more concerned, especially the junior man, which was the flight engineer. There was three in the cockpit. Another interesting feature of this is that there were three other pilots on the plane, and the flight engineer went back and woke them up and brought them up front. They were deadheading back to the UK. Anyway, eventually what happens is they're getting quite nervous, and the flight engineer, who had less duties, was able to get up and look, estimated that he thought they were only half a mile between them. And he's saying to the pilot, Kurt, if anything breaks off this or anything goes wrong, we've had it. We've got to evade this thing. We got to do something. And he leaned forward and cupped his hands up to the windshield screen to keep the little bit of light in the cockpit away from him. And what he said was, at that point, he realized that these four lights were not external. They were internal. And in fact, he was looking into the UFO.
That's amazing.
And he says, at that point, I felt sick to my stomach, he said. And I said, man, we got to get out. So at this point, the pilot agrees, tells them all to get in their seat. They're going to come out of autopilot and take the yoke and be ready. And just at that point, the UFO starts putting some distance between them. And it gets up to a point, let's say roughly it's about 3 miles ahead of the aircraft. And then suddenly it just vectors up, and in 10 seconds is up and out of the atmosphere.
That's amazing. Now, I'm going to tell you something that you might find shocking. I was mentioning Pan Am 160 earlier. This was a cargo flight. It used to go from JFK, and it would go to Germany sometimes. And it had a fire in the cockpit. Everyone died on it. It crashed on November 3rd, 1973. I'm wondering if that crew was the same crew that you were just talking about.
It was not the same crew. I was lucky enough to, like I say, have the co-pilot come up here to Canada, interview him face-to-face. The pilot that night, Kurt Olson, was deceased at this point from old age, I believe.
Okay.
And
okay.
I talked to the flight engineer at length while he was mountain climbing in Colorado. And it wouldn't have been the same crew, and there would have been more than one crew. And at that point, I think he had moved on in his career to another airline. In fact, I think JAL, strangely enough.
Okay. And maybe the same plane, though. It was a Boeing 707.
May have been. I'll have to look into that. That would be a great follow-up.
Yeah, and it was a crew of three people. So, 7 years would have gone by since the Shag Harbor incident. when that other plane crashed. But that's ironic.
I guess the last communication that night in the cockpit, you can picture this. First of all, the second flight crew never went back to sleep. They were too excited, right? And the other thing is that, you know, it's just like watching Close Encounters of the Third Time. The last communication that night was two requests from Logan as to if they wanted to file a UFO report. And although the junior men wanted to, the pilot declined.
Yep.
Just like that scene, you see. And the interesting thing is the guy says, well, I'm now going to hand you off to Moncton Center in Canadian airspace. Have a great flight, guys, and watch for that UFO, you know.
Graham, is there any chance that you can find any physical evidence of this case, or is it basically done?
The 50-year declassification is coming up for Shag Harbor in Canada. Things come up for declassification after 50 years. So we're really trying to put a push on as many sources as we can to see if we can unearth anything at this point. We're also going to look into KGB files and U.S. files. But beyond that, you know, we know that there's, beyond the documents, we know that there's the artifacts and the film that were dropped off to the Defense Research Board. So that's the Canadian Military Scientific Research. But there's also another artifact I don't think was mentioned that the lighthouse keeper in the area found, and it was a long cylinder that had strange symbols on it, and that was scorched, that we believe came off of one of the craft that night. And when Chris spoke to Irving Banks, it turned out that the Coast Guard instructed him to wrap it up, and he handed the object to a U.S. Naval Intelligence officer. So we know that there's a few different artifacts. We know there's film, still film and movie film. And there's one other interesting possible physical artifact, and that would be just outside the initial crash site, BIO, which is basically government underwater research, they did a side scan sonar of the area. Chris mentioned that in the 80s they were looking for something else, but they noticed that there was these large, strange anomalies that they thought were man-made. So recently we've had a friend of ours named David Civet do dives in that area. And this is the last chapter of the book. He wrote it on one of his dives. So he found those artifacts, what we believe is those artifacts. So he's planning another dive to take scientific tests. But what they are four perfectly round, symmetrical depressions, about 20 feet wide each, in a diamond pattern. You know, they were totally anomalous to the area. They had no vegetation growing in them. And if you recall that many witnesses described the bottom of one of the UFOs as being on fire, you know, heating up very high and then cooling down. I believe that that could have fused, when it hit the bottom, it could have fused these circles. So we're hoping that with the next dive, the test will show whether it was created by high heat, this sort of thing.
Now, you'd mentioned that you're coming up on the 50th year of declassification here. Why would they classify these in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. Chris, you want to address that?
Yeah, kind of a mixed bag. You know, one of the unique features of this case, there's a lot of them, like I said, you know, the fact that no one reported a UFO. One of the other neat things is there's a huge paper trail here that's beyond question in Canada. When I first looked into it, there was a large amount of unrestricted documents, and they had always been. People just hadn't done the footwork in the past before they entered the public record. And these are the actual military telexes between the bases, and they speak quite clearly of the government search for what it believed to be a genuine UFO. I mean, some of these are quite exciting in themselves, you know, documents where, and you know what's most telling here, George, is not the body of text in it reporting the facts, but the margin notes made by the officials. There's a great one I love. It has UFO scrawled on the top in big letters and underlined three times. I've looked at thousands of these things, and this is the only one at Defense Headquarters that has that kind of strength of reaction. And when you read all the other margin notes, you can feel the excitement of the men all these years later and what was going on. But the fact is there's more to this. There is at some point a black box element to this case. And there is still the hope of finding something. It would be difficult. Mm-hmm. It's particularly tantalizing saying that people like banks and others claim to have found something, and I would have to say mishandled it and turned it over to the wrong people. The other thing is that when I interviewed Squadron Leader William Bain in Ottawa back in 94, and he was the fellow running the air desk in Ottawa at the time in this investigation from headquarters, he told me that he felt that it was very possible that they've been stick-handled by the U.S. people involved. And this would tend to confirm that.
And, Chris, you have no doubt that something on October 4th, 1967, plunged into the water.
No, it's beyond question. It's a matter of history. The thing is, there's no missing or late aircraft, no incoming space junk, right?
Nothing.
When you look at the flight characteristics, I mean, it's a pretty short list of what's left.
Nobody reported a small plane that went down. There's nothing.
None. Nothing's late. Nothing was missing. This is the thing. And, it's just so tantalizing. It's a case that the more you look into it, it's never been explained or explained away. It just doesn't evaporate. And, it was very encouraging in the beginning, and people saw the worth of it. You know, it had always been a great case, but somehow I think because we're not too mysterious and far away, it just kind of slipped. But when I went down, it's amazing how the UFO community reacted to this, and both sides of it, I'll be honest. You know, I went down not knowing if anybody in the U.S. wanted to hear this little Canadian story again, and I was shocked to see how well it was embraced by people. Kevin Randall, Antonio Yunaeus, Stanton Friedman, and people, MUFON, which, you know, Lended Assistance gave great help and certainly helped promote it and try to bring together. Jan Aldrich, who found some very significant documents, people pulled together and helped them, were very supportive. It was so encouraging and just kept me going in the beginning. And it was an exciting time. And, the case still is exciting because, it holds together. There's no weather balloon here.
Any frustration point for you, Chris?
Well, sure. Sure there is. I mean, it's interesting that still in this country, I mean, Canada in 1967 wasn't New Mexico in 47. You know, things are much more open here. There was a greater expectation. But
right. Still
there's a point of cutoff where people aren't comfortable. Still there's a point where they withhold rather than release, right? And in some ways, it was more of a sophisticated, subtle cover-up, which is the only kind that would have worked up here. In some ways, is a more open society, although sometimes I feel that's slipping away in this country, too.
All right, we're going to take calls while we continue chatting with Chris Stiles and Graham Sims. Let's go to Bruce in Hollywood, Florida. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Graham. I listen to you every night, George. I drive a truck at night.
Well, thank you, sir, and thank you for what you do.
Well, I actually deliver gasoline to gas stations.
Good.
I have an interesting story. I made it as brief as I can. My father has been doing business in the Bahamas since the mid-50s. And on the east side of Andros Island, which is the largest island in the Bahamas, there's an area about 160 miles long, about 35 miles wide, called the Tongue of the Ocean. And it's all very deep, anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 feet deep. And I was just kind of looking around there, and I found something that it should not have been there. It was an orangish, brownish, different hues of that color. And I showed it to my dad, and he says, "Oh, that shouldn't be there. It's not a reef. There's no reefs that you can see that come up from that kind of depth." And I looked at it for months and months, and then one day went there, and it was blued out. Google had blued it out. The interesting thing is that you had a gentleman on a number of months ago that mentioned this and mentioned a submarine base. They call it the submarine base.
Yeah.
It's called AUTEC. Now, AUTEC stands for Andros Underwater Test and Evaluation Center. Now, it started after 1947, and what they used to do is run ships through this area and get the signature. Every ship, even if it's a sister ship, has its own fingerprint of all the different machines that are working. That way submarines can identify ships via the sound they make going through the water. Now, they're not doing that anymore. And that base is about 50 miles away from this object. And then one day I went there, and it had been blewed out by Google.
And, have you ever – well, let me ask Chris or Graham. What do you think of that, where Google blots it out after he has found something? Exactly.
Well, that has to give you a queasy feeling, doesn't it? You know. We can only speculate as to why they would hide us from that. You know, once it comes to the public's attention or something interesting's found out. But, you know, in today's world, it's easily done. I don't know. There's a lot of things that are blocked out. But
speaking of speculation, though, I want to ask you, Chris, and then you, Graham, the same question. What do you think happened at Shag Harbor?
Well, you know, believe it or not, when I first got in, it used to drive me crazy, George, and I spent endless time speculating as to point of origin, mission, these kind of things. And it may sound odd to your audience, but I got so involved in the nuts and bolts and just trying to drag this thing into the life of day that I tend to leave those questions to greater minds than myself, right? It's fun to speculate about them. My job, I felt, was just to prove that indeed it happened. I wanted to bring a case forward that was undeniable, that didn't evaporate or get explained away. I wanted something that I thought would force drag UFO reality into the light of day for skeptics. And I'd like to point out at this point that, you know, I mentioned a number of names of people that helped and, you know, promote this case and lend their efforts to the cause, you know, Stanton, Kevin Randall, Unaeus, Mufon, Walt Andrus in the past, these things. But you know something? One of the things that sticks in my mind was when I first met Phil Klass, and I was in
the Skeptic. North Carolina.
The Skeptic. And he come up to me after I did my presentation. He was sitting right in the front row with his little hand stuck out with his little cassette recorder, right? And I've seen him in the past fall asleep with others and this, and I thought, oh, God, here we go, showtime. But afterwards, he come up and he had this huge grin, put his arm around me and says, well, I can retire now. You Canadian guys have explained it all. And he says, no, something did happen there, didn't it? And I said, well, of course. I said, I didn't expect to hear that from you. Well, he says, I'm going to go home. I'll probably explain it on my website. Don't let that bother you. Amazing work, great case, and he wanted to get his picture taken with me. He was very gracious. And, you know, as a boy, first reading things like the UFO experience in the early books and seeing his picture, to me was the devil incarnate, and suddenly this old man was ahead of me, and he was very gracious, and it completely disarmed me. But I've had a lot of letters that come from skeptics saying that they thought that this case is the kind that can make that difference, right? I don't know. You know, I hardly take the time. I think it was a mission of surveillance. I think it was a test of penetration of our skies and defense systems. Beyond that, I don't know. I'll leave that to greater minds. What I've proved is that these things happen, and they continue to happen.
Sure.
And they're not explained, and they're not explained away, George.
Graham, we'll talk with you about this as well, and we'll take final phone calls in just a moment. Chris Stiles with us, Graham Sims, their book, Impact to Contact. Their website, of course, is ArcadiaHousePub.com, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. We'll be right back. Well, our next Magical Mystery Tour takes us to a live stage event in Toronto, Canada, at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre. Full information by going to GeorgeNoriLive.com. And if you're in that area, Toronto, come on out and see us. We'll be back in a moment with Graham Sims and Chris Stiles as we talk about the Shag Harbor incident. Okay, welcome back. We're with Chris Stiles, Graham Sims, talking about their work, Impact to Contact. And Chris, earlier you were talking about the other researcher, David Savette, and these anomalies that could be out there. Let's go through those again. What are some of the strange things going on out there at Shag Harbor?
Well, the features that Graham had mentioned earlier are, like you said, a set of depressions that are out on a part of the harbor. They're beyond the impact site by about a mile and a half, in an area known as the Rip, an area with very challenging currents and whatever. And what's clear is when we first discovered these things from a former side scan sonar survey, is that all the possibilities had already been looked into for interpretation. Like, they're not spud can depressions from drilling rigs. They're not dredging spoils. They're nothing anthropomorphic. And at the same time, they don't match any known natural features. So again, it leaves a short list and something that requires further investigations. You may think, how challenging is this? It's not that deep at that point, the water, but outside the current, there are other challenges. One of the things is that you can't visually see them. There's so much life in the water there, and that often visibility can be as low as, you know, 10 feet. So if you're standing in a depression or a circle that's 20 feet across, you can't physically see it. So even to know you're there, sometimes you need sonar confirmation. So, you know, these are the kind of unique challenges when you start looking at physical evidence and you're trying to separate it from a natural feature.
Have there been any other incidents or reports of UFOs prior to the Shag Harbor incident? Graham, would you know that?
Absolutely. Before I got cut off, I was mentioning the history of the folklore there. To me, it seems clear that there's been UFO activity going back hundreds of years. Now, they didn't have the lexicon back there back then, so they called them ghost ships, basically. But in the citizens' hearing on disclosure in D.C., Richard French, who was a Blue Book advisor, he described a very similar experience in Newfoundland in the 50s that he investigated, and in which there was a disc, actually it was two discs, just under the surface off the coast of St. John's, Newfoundland, and there was also supposedly ETs involved with that. So, you know, there is a history of anomalous activity in the area.
It's an incredible case. Okay, back to the calls we go now. Let's go to Melissa in Wyoming, first-time caller. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. My question is he was talking about Mallet being a messenger of God,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But others are saying that they're demonic. And I'll take my answer off the line if you could tell me what that means, the difference.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Melissa. Are they demonic, Chris?
I'm gonna deflect that one to Graham, George.
All right, Graham, we pop it over to you.
I really don't think so. One of the things Dr. Mack kept coming back to is that our language around this topic is really in its infancy, and it makes it difficult to talk about these topics because our language is so dualistic. So the word alien, you know, has certain connotations, and it's just so general. So that gives rise to these types of dualistic, concepts. Obviously, if there are demons, you know, well, we could say those are alien because they're not human. But the truth is, I find, these right-wing Christian views on the demonic as not useful and not accurate. Certainly, you know, ETs are like people, a lot of them. And, they get into the fallen angels type things. Maybe some of them are negative, but certainly a lot of them are positive. So it's more subtle than that.
Why work in a shroud of secrecy, though? And it's obvious they do.
Well, I mean, it might come back to the, our human will, that they need us to evolve on our own to some degree. And when we're ready, then I think they will show themselves. And I think that's really what they've been doing since, with incidents like this, since 47, say 47 to 67. They show themselves just so we know they're there, so we can sort of chew on it, so we can think about it, so our unconscious, our subconscious, will sort of start processing it. So they just show themselves, and then we get to evolve our understanding of it, something like that, I believe.
Let's go to Abraham in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma now. Abraham, thanks for calling. You're up with us.
Hi, how are you doing, George?
Good. Thank you.
Oh, man, nervous to be on your show. I love your show. I listen to you every night. I have a story. When I was 7 years old, maybe younger, me and my older sister, we went outside to talk. For whatever reason, we went up to our back porch. And the strangest thing happened. The sky lit up just neon green for a second. It looked like, if you could just imagine the backyard, just neon green for like a split second. It was so fast. It looked like whatever was in the sky went into our neighbor's yard. Now, that was weird. But then sometime later, my sister woke up in the morning and had a mark on her chest. And this mark looked like a power symbol, you know, like on your VCR or your TV.
Okay.
And it just looked, it was never there before. We don't know how it got there. So, I mean, I don't know. She thinks she was abducted. Nobody believes her. I mean, I had that experience with her, so I believe her to an extent, you know. I've always been skeptic of the whole thing. But that's my story.
All right, let's check in with Graham. Thanks for that story. What do you think of these abduction cases, Graham? I mean, you worked with John Mack, who spent his career investigating them. Is something going on, or are these people got some kind of mental issue?
There's definitely something going on. I mean, I think that's, he showed that quite clearly. The abduction scenario tends to evolve over time into more of a relationship with these ETs. And while there is a secrecy around it, you know, there has been a lot of contact going on for, you know, since the 20s. Direct human one-on-one contact between ETs and people. That's peaceful, that's enlightening, beyond the abduction scenario.
Let's go next to Jason in Toronto, Canada. Hi, Jace. Go ahead.
Mr. George Norrie, it's a pleasure. Long-time listener, first-time caller. It's an
honor
to get
through. Thank you, Jason. Great.
I just wanted to have a general question. All the visitations over the thousands of years, the reports from every case that's been discussed on Coast and other programs and whatnot, you just talked about, sir, how there's been one-on-one contact. It's been enlightening and very thorough. Why hasn't a good race, or a bad race for that matter, revealed themselves to the human beings in a mass scale? I'd like to know your opinion. Why just a one-on-one, certain people are chosen and not a mass, like to the masses, landing on the White House lawn, that is. I take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay. And that's a good question. Why not that mass sighting, not like Phoenix, but where they actually come down and say, hey, here we are. Graham?
Well, that's a very profound question, you know, and I can't pretend to have the answer. But I do believe that, okay, say again, between 47 and 67, there was so much going on. We're coming out of the horrors of World War II. We're going into the Cold War. So it's almost like our collective unconscious, in the face of possible annihilation, that humanity released a psychological and spiritual cry for help. And the universe's response to this was the increase in UFO activity seen around the world. So I think perhaps they're conditioning us through the media and through these sightings to get ready for some future event.
What do you think, Chris?
I think Carl Sagan nailed it quite well in his fictional work, Contact.
Great book. And great movie. Book,
great story, great outlook, and I think he nailed it. And for anybody who's unaware, Carl Sagan was a closet ufologist.
I think he was, too, and he kind of hinted in some of his works. Which
Think that Americans weren't, millions weren't bothered in their bed every night. He thought it was far less frequent, right? But he was a believer, and he fought hard to sustain those records when others, like Howard Pinzel, wanted to destroy the Blue Book files.
Well, the Benny and Barney Hill case was extraordinary, something that Stanton Friedman also worked on.
Yeah. I got to know Betty quite well and spoke with her on several occasions.
Great.
You know, and I could tell you one little story about her that I found so interesting. Is she asked me what to me, because she thought of me as a nuts and bolts person, which was a little unfair because I take a blended view of the phenomena, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
She asked me one time when we were having breakfast, I think we were in Rochester, New York, doing a MUFON conference. And she said, Chris, what would it take to convince you that the abduction phenomena was real? And I tried to explain I wasn't trying to say it wasn't. And I said, you know what would make me feel more comfortable and feel even stronger about it, Betty, is if somebody found a diary and it was from before your experience. And even though it didn't use the word, it could be seen as nothing else but you. And she laughed and cackled and pointed at me and she said, there's wisdom.
I love that.
Yeah.
This entire episode of Shag Harbor, are they talking about it today, or has it gone away?
Well, no, it hasn't gone away. I mean, the community still grapples with it. Life goes on. you know, they fish. People here don't have a lot of expendable income. It's something that intruded into their life. And, you know, the community has mixed feelings about it.
Right.
And, you know, it hasn't been much of a tourist thing here. Things are quite different in this country.
Well, those people, they're the salt of the earth, aren't they?
Well, you know, like I say, when they come out, their only concern was for survivors. You know, a UFO, Roswell, none of these things were on their mind. And they had to adjust their view to look at it. And it's ironic, and maybe that's the reason it did happen there. I don't know if there is a reason. I mean, if this is a ET, their purposes are their own.
Do you think it was more of a crash, Chris, than a submersible
landing? Well,
it seems
to be more of a controlled ditch, if anything, that was the place they entered the water, you know, to go elsewhere, right? But, I mean, the thing is, you know, it's so unique, and I know sometimes in the U.S. they you know, you have to paint that backdrop first. There is no Roswell as far as the case is concerned. There is no this. It's very different. There's no controversy. The other thing about these documents, were always open and available, and when people see them, you can send away in this country if you're a Canadian citizen. You don't have to take my word. Get your own copy. There's absolutely no controversy as to the origin of authenticity like there is in the MJ-12 case that people still grapple with and are trying to drag it to the light of day. Here, it's pretty straightforward. This happened.
Let's go to Tammy in Columbus, Ohio. Good morning, Tammy. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you about a UFO I saw in the 60s. My grandparents owned some cottages on Indian Rocks Beach in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and my brothers and I went down there, and we lived in one of the cottages there that they owned. And it must have been some kind of a holiday or something, because we... During the summer, the children would come with their parents and stay in the cottages. But in the winter, you know, it was just mainly adults. So there were a lot of children there. And it was late at night, and we were on the beach, and my grandparents had these tiki torches lit up, stuck in the sand on the beach, you know.
Yep.
And I must have been about 7 or 8 years old. And we were playing Twister, and the parents were standing around with their drinks and talking and everything. And all of a sudden, this light came up from the north. We were right on the Gulf of Mexico, right on Indian Rocks Beach, looking out towards the Gulf, out towards the water. And a light came from the north, was going like southwest almost. And as it got closer to us, it was really big, and when it got above us, it was so big we couldn't even see the sky anymore.
Could you see structure in it, Tammy?
It was round. It was round, and it was metallic. And I don't remember a whole lot of detail. I just remember thinking, well, the adults, I heard one of the adults say, "What is that?" And then they didn't seem afraid, you know. So us kids, you know, we weren't afraid, and some of the kids went back to playing Twister, but I stood there and watched it, and when it got right over us, it was so huge that you couldn't even see the sky anymore. And then it stayed there for, I don't know how long, maybe a few minutes, and then it went off up way up into the sky towards the southwest, and it went really fast, and when it got so far away, it was a tiny speck again.
Yeah, they turned into little type, it's good, like stars, I guess. Chris, it's amazing, though, how many people are reporting seeing these very strange things. Do you get a lot of reports now in Canada, too?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, they come in, and there's no doubt that the majority of them are misinterpretation or can be explained away. Sometimes people don't know what they see. The most common thing I have reported, and sometimes even by pilots, that they see, and you can do checking and find out that often the ISS, when seen under, you know, ideal conditions, can spurn reports. But again, you know, there's still that steady percentage. I don't know, for me, it's around 20% that you can't explain or explain away, or they just such unusual flight characteristics or features. You know it's something, you know, not of this world.
All you need is one case
right.
of something
just
totally unexplainable. That's
yeah.
That's right. Graham, I hear that you guys may be working on a movie here.
Yes, we've got a few things on the go. We're planning on a graphic novel of the case. There was actually a comic version of it that came out in the late 60s. But we're going to do a modern adaptation. And we've turned our hand to a screenplay, whether it's a feature length or like a TV series. So if you have any connections in L.A. there, George, let us know.
There are many out here, you two, many indeed. Now, where do we get the book, Impact to Contact?
It's available online at arcadiahousepub.com. And we're sold out in the bookstores in Canada, so we'll be doing another print run. And the ebook is also available there.
Absolutely. And Chris, I assume you continue to investigate UFO reports?
Well, as I can, you know, I'm still just a working guy. It's something that's gone way beyond a hobby. But, yeah, you know, the interest is always there. There's always more to this case. Shag Harper, from the start, has been a compelling argument for UFO reality, and it remains the world's only UFO crash scenario that is supported in that interpretation by government documents that are freely available and entirely without controversy as to their origin or their authenticity.
It will be interesting to see what happens with these documents when they're declassified.
Well, we're looking forward to that. And if anybody out there, if there's any whistleblowers who want to give us a hand on that, we welcome that.
Great. Chris, thank you. Graham, thank you as well for being on the program. Really appreciate it. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back tomorrow with some more incredible shows for you. But, again, this case, the Shag Harbor incident, is one of the best out there. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.